sky is very important to us, and it brings back for a lot of us a lot of different memories. In fact, when I look back on my life, the first song that I ever remember, that I remember having heard, I can't think of anything before that. I'm sure there was some little kid's song. But the first song you might hear on the radio was Over the Rainbow by Judy Garland, 1939 Academy Award song, a winning song. And it was still around. That was in sometime around 1950, 51. We were living in Alaska at the time, and I don't even remember if I was there or back in California when I heard it, but that's as far back as I go that in my memory. And that was my first song that I think of, and I really like the jazzed-up version. They have a jazzier version. I like that even better. But it was a beautiful song. A lot of people thought it was. It had survived through the war, and it was a memory for me. And rainbows are fascinating, I think, especially for young people, children. You see that rainbow there and all the colors, and it's a beautiful sight. It's been kind of co-opted by a certain group of people today, but it was God that put the rainbow there. God knew how light traveled through water and everything, and he gave us the rainbow. Let us know that he would not destroy the earth in that way again. That he would not use a flood to destroy the earth. About that time, as I said, we were living in Alaska. And my father was, at that time, he was in photography. Took a lot of pictures of celebrities and generals coming through. And Bob Hope and various other ones, when they came through, he was an official photographer. And I remember they had a big photo lab there, and I'm sure they were doing a lot more than just taking pictures of celebrities, but he never said fully what they were doing. But he was always trying to get a picture of the Northern Lights. Kodachrome had only come out a few years earlier, a decade or so earlier, I think about 1935. In other words, color film. And he was always trying to get good pictures of the Northern Lights. And I know the Northern Lights are something that many of you have never seen, and some of you have. And it's something you'd like to see in person. And the Northern Lights can be very spectacular, or they can be very ordinary. Sometimes you don't know if it's a city off in the distance because there's nothing colorful about it, just kind of a glow over there. And sometimes you have to look at it for a while to try to figure out if it's Northern Lights or just a city off on the horizon. But other times it is spectacularly beautiful. I remember one time in Minnesota, the Northern Lights were, it was at the summer camp, and they really went from horizon to horizon, every direction. And right above us, it was like a round hole in the sky. I remember another time fishing with another with a friend, and we had a young fellow that we had taken fishing. It was about midnight, and we were on this beautiful lake. It was to see the trout swimming around underneath and everything, and I happened to turn around, and here was a beautiful display of Northern Lights, of just like little fingers going up into the sky. It wasn't a huge display, but it was a beautiful display because it was very colorful. I can also remember as a young person, early teens, when we lived in England, we would lay down sometimes. We'd travel all over the countryside there. We'd go fishing downtown. We had campouts. We'd sometimes just lay in the tall, dry grass of the English countryside there and look up at the sky, and we'd spot various animals in the clouds. And I'll bet that probably everybody has done that at some time or another. You look up and, well, that looks like a lion, or that looks like an alligator. And sometimes they start out one way and they change as being something else, maybe a bird. And I think that's something that many young people do. But we would lay there in the grass and we'd be looking up the sky, and we'd talk about our hopes and our dreams and what we'd like to do in life. Pretty immature at that point in time as far as what we might do in life, but we would look up and kind of form our dreams in the sky. The sky is a very beautiful thing, but there are also dark skies, dark clouds. I also remember when I lived in Alaska that we lived in a, it was a 6 or 8 plex, kind of like a, you know, just a single story, nothing. Maybe it was off the ground because of water and snow and different things like that, but it was just, it was just one story, and there were about 6 or 8 of these apartments that were attached together, and it was one room. We just had one room, the kitchen, the living room. It'd be like a motel room, but a poor motel room. And the bathroom was separate. Everything else was the same. And my parents had bunk beds for us, and they would hang up army blankets there to kind of block off the rest of the house at night so that we could go to sleep. But we also used those blankets from time to time to put over the windows because they were blackout drills. The Soviet Union had gotten the bomb in, what was it, 1948 or 9, I forget exactly. This was 1950 and 1951. They had the bomb. This was not long after World War II, and there was a very serious concern. The Cold War had begun. The term had been used a couple times before 1950, but by 1947, that term was being used, apparently. I don't remember it, but researching it a little bit. And we had blackout drills because they did not want housing to be seen by air. I don't know that that would have been a big deal where we live. We were out in the middle of nowhere with just a very, very small community, but that's where we were. But it was a blackout, a fear of war that could come. I remember as a young man, I'd be frightened by thunderstorms. Never liked thunderstorms. My father always said he loved them, and when we moved to the Midwest and saw some of the spectacular thunderstorms, that became more interesting to me. And they can be frightening, but they can also be absolutely beautiful. Coming back from Wichita one time, I saw this whole line of storms, and it was just constant flashing, never ceased until I caught up with it, and I wish I hadn't, because it was very violent. We lived under the mushroom cloud growing up. It was Cold War time, and I still remember, not strong memories, but I do remember where we would have to go into the hall and hunker down against the walls or underneath our desks in case there was a war. And I know that there are many others of you right here, if you're my age, you still remember that as well, or very likely you do. The Cold War was on. I also remember when we lived on Strategic Air Command bases, Lake and Heath in England and Vandenberg in California, especially there, where it's a missile base, and you know a little bit what they're doing there, why you have missiles. Didn't know all the secrets of it all, but knew that if a war started with Russia, you always knew you were sitting at ground zero. And I remember one time having a nightmare about that. I was a teenager at the time, probably 15, 16, and the bomb exploded. It was my alarm clock, thankfully. But that's a type of thing that we grew up under, a certain cloud, a dark cloud. Well, this afternoon, I'm going to address the future dark clouds that are pictured by this Feast of Trumpets. But also, I'll address that there's a time when there's a bright, shiny cloud, when there is a blue sky and white, fluffy clouds, and it's going to bring light to a very troubled world, because that's also contained in the meaning of this day. So if you want to title it, it would be Clouds on the Horizon. The day of the Lord will be preceded by heavenly signs. Notice over in Joel, the second chapter. And you'll note that some of these things have been covered in one way or the other, but as I figure it, then if I'm giving the same thing that was given before, it'll be a little different, but the fact of the matter is that probably you need it. You didn't get it the first time. Although I hope you got it the first time, because Mr. Smith gave a very, very fine sermon and some very good points that I hope that we will put into practice in our lives. But here in Joel, the second chapter, in verse 30, it says, I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord. So that's right before the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is pictured by these seven trumpets that are blown. As Mr. Smith pointed out in chapter 6 of Revelation, we have six of the seven seals opened up. And then we'll look at this a little bit in just a minute here. But we come to the seventh seal, and the seventh seal is the day of the Lord, the one-year day of the Lord. And it's a time that is described by those seven trumpets. He read through chapters 8 and 9, and that's fine because I'd like to cover in a little bit different way here. But let's notice over in Matthew 24, the Bible is so consistent. We just had Joel in the Old Testament, and now we go to Matthew 24 and verse 29, and it tells us the same thing. It says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, that's the time of Satan's wrath. That's a 2.5-year period of Satan's wrath. He says, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Now, the powers of the heavens could refer to spirit beings. They are powers. Or it could be talking about the solar system in some ways. We know that eventually the sun's going to burn out. God will renew it somehow, in some way. We're not sure about all the details of that. Of course, with the Father and the Son and those who are God's people, we won't need the sun for light in that way. But nevertheless, it says the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet. And they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. So we see here, coming on the clouds of heaven, the sound of a trumpet. And as it says elsewhere, the shout of the archangel. So it's going to be, whether it's a shout or trumpet, it's kind of combined there, but he is going to come back. But these heavenly signs are going to precede the seven trumpet blasts. Over in Revelation 6, this was covered a little bit this morning, but let's notice again, Revelation 6. After we have the four horsemen of the apocalypse and the martyrdom of saints, which is the fifth seal, we come to verse 12. And it says, I looked when he opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became like blood. Now, when it speaks of the powers of the heavens being shaken, we don't know exactly what all that means, but it means something here, as it says in verse 13, the stars of heaven will fall to the earth. We speak of shooting stars. We know that a literal star is not going to come on the earth or consume us. But a meteor shower that is not expected, it's not the one that comes in November every year. I forget the name of it, but some of you know the name of that particular meteor shower. It comes late in the year. But the sun became black as sackcloth, and the moon became like blood, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth as a fig tree drops its late figs when it's shaken by a mighty wind. Now, I imagine that's going to be a terrifying time. And in fact, we know it's going to be a terrifying time because God tells us it's going to scare the daylights out of people. The sky receded as a scroll. What does that mean? When it is rolled up. And every mountain and island was moved out of its place, as Mr. Smith was talking about there, exactly what that means. We don't know the totality of it, whether it's just moved an inch or two or three or just shaken in some some massive way. The kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave and every free man hid themselves in the caves and in the rocks of the mountains. It's going to be terrifying, and it's pointing out here that it doesn't matter who you are at that time. You can have all the money in the world. You could be an Elon Musk. You can be a great person like one of our presidents or one of the dictators around here. It doesn't really matter who it is. The commanders, these are military men. They're going to be hiding in caves or any place they can. I always wondered, well, how many caves are there? But you move to Kansas City, and they talk about going down in the caves because there's a lot of limestone there, and they've carved out these places where they store food, semi-trucks. I've been into one of them in a semi-truck, you know, a big transport truck. We had a friend there, and he was delivering there, and they have a marathon in one of them every year. And so there's all kinds of caves there, and there are other places that have them in southern Missouri and elsewhere. But there are caves, and certainly out here in the mountains, there are caves. There are places people are going to hide. They're going to be digging for cover, so to speak, wherever they are and whatever they have, whether it be a desk or a wall or a cave or, you know, a bomb shelter or a root shelter. They're going to be heading out for those places. So there, it doesn't matter who they are, whether they're free, whether they're slaves, whether they're commanders. Verse 16, and they said to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. This is not the Jesus Christ that the world looks to. They can't imagine that he would be filled with wrath. But look around our world. Look how we have rebelled against our Creator. If you were Jesus Christ, would you not be a bit upset at what mankind has done after all that you've done for mankind? For the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand? So we see that the day of the Lord will be preceded by heavenly signs. That's the lead up to it. And then it talks about the 144,000 and the great innumerable multitude that God is going to protect during that time, or that have come out of great tribulation. Then chapters 8 and 9, as Mr. Smith read through them this morning, are the seven trumpets, or the six of the seven trumpets that will be introducing various plagues in various terrible times. Now, there are several scriptures that we could turn to besides the actual seven trumpets that tell us about the day of the Lord. For example, in Ezekiel, the 30th chapter, Ezekiel 30, and beginning in verse 1, verses 1 to 3, it says, the word of the Lord came to me again, saying, son of man, prophesy and say, thus says the Lord God, wail, woe to the day, for the day is near, even the day of the Lord is near. And how does it describe it? It will be a day of clouds, the time of the Gentiles, a day of clouds. Now, I'm sure that there's a certain amount of literal explanation there, as we've already seen some scriptures talking about that. But it's also just talking about a day of dark clouds, a day of where there's a cloud hanging over your head, so to speak. We even use that expression. This person has a dark cloud hanging over his head. Everything goes wrong. Notice over in the book of Joel, once again, and Joel is about the day of the Lord. It mentions it several times. But let's notice Joel, the second chapter. In verses 1 and 2, it says, blow the trumpet in Zion, and sound an alarm in my holy mountain. There's a connection between trumpets and this time, the day of the Lord. He says, let all the inhabitants of the earth and the land tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming, for it is at hand. And how does it describe it? A day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness, like the morning clouds spread over the mountains. And it speaks of a people coming great and strong that has never been the like. I used to think, as Mr. Smith did, that some of the descriptions, especially in the book of Revelation there, of an army. And here it even talks about locusts earlier in the chapter, or the chapter before. A helicopter gunship looks like a locust. It's shaped like it, narrow in the tail, big bulb in front. But you really have to wonder, even whether they're shaped like them or not, when you see drones coming up by the thousands, like a locust cloud. You wonder, what is out there? And not only are there weapons that haven't been discovered or implemented yet, there are others out there that you and I know nothing about. They're there. And they may even be being used to some degree. We just don't know about it. But there are those that are out there. And we know that there's a time of unusual pains and suffering that comes as a result of the beast coming out of the bottomless pit, and for a period of 5 months it inflicts severe pain but not death to people. So we don't know what's out there exactly. But when it speaks of a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness, it may be literal in part, but it is certainly figurative in that sense. It's a dark time, a scary time. Let's notice over in Isaiah, the second chapter. I'm sorry, let's go to Zephaniah, first of all. Zephaniah. That's Zephaniah, right before Haggai, which is before Zechariah, which is before Malachi. So, near the end of the Old Testament. Zephaniah, the first chapter. And verse 14. Again, it speaks of the day of the Lord. It says, the great day of the Lord is near. It is near and hastens quickly. The noise of the day of the Lord, or the day of the eternal, is bitter. There the mighty men shall cry out. That day is a day of wrath, a day of trouble and distress, a day of devastation and desolation, a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness, a day of trumpet and alarm, against the fortified cities and against the high towers. So here we see it's a time of darkness, of dark clouds, a time of just fearfulness that hangs over mankind. Verse 17, I will bring distress upon men, and they shall walk like blind men, because they have sinned against the eternal. Their blood shall be poured out like dust, and their flesh like refuse. Neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them in the day of the Lord's wrath. But the whole land shall be devoured by the fire of his jealousy, for he will make speedy riddance of all those who dwell in the land. This is what the day of the Lord is all about. Those first six trumpets, it's one after another over a period of a year. When we look at what's happening in our world, things are happening quickly. We see a war in Europe. We see this war in the Middle East. We see an escalation of it from one day to another or 2 weeks. It's not what's going to happen next year or what's going to happen 6 months from now. It's what's going to happen tomorrow. We simply do not know. Things are happening so quickly. So we have this disaster. As someone put it, we have the southeast, the United States, is underwater. The Middle East is on fire. And we have a longshoreman strike that is going to aggravate so much else. And we wonder, it's not political, it's just a statement, who is in charge of our government? Nobody really knows. Well, somebody knows. But when everything is exploding around us, we have this situation where we don't know what to do. It's just one thing after another that piles on top of it. And we don't know when we wake up tomorrow, or even when we get out of services and, turn on a cell phone or something, we don't know what we're going to wake up to. And if anybody thinks there's a Savior other than Jesus Christ, you're kidding yourself. Nobody, I don't care who's elected, is going to solve these problems. They're too intractable, and I'll get to that in just a minute here. Let's go over to Isaiah, the second chapter. Why are these things going to happen? Why is God so wrathful, so angry with mankind? Well, let's go back to Isaiah, the second chapter. I'll get it right here, verse 10. Isaiah 2 and verse 10. It says, enter into the rock and hide in the dust. We've already seen a little bit of that. Why? From the terror of the Lord, or the Eternal, and the glory of His majesty. The lofty looks of man shall be humbled. Do we see mankind today as being very arrogant? Our leaders and others? The lofty looks of man shall be humbled. The haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and the Eternal alone shall be exalted in that day. For the day of the Lord of hosts, verse 12, shall come upon everything proud and lofty. Now, we might not think of our world as just being filled with pride and vanity and all, but the fact that we think we know more than God, that we don't need God, that we can do away with God through some sort of a process called evolution, and all the things that we think we know better than, as Mr. Smith brought out, it's about me, it's about who I am, what I want, and my destiny. I forget exactly how he put it, but I think you remember the point he was making. Shall come upon everything proud and lofty, upon everything lifted up, and it shall be brought low, upon all the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up, and upon all the oaks of Bashan. You know, we read that and we think, well, what exactly does that mean? Well, as it brought out this morning, sometimes these things are symbolic. You know, you can read about Nebuchadnezzar and the dream that he had and what Daniel revealed to him, that the tree was going to be cut down, yet its roots would still be alive and it would come back later. A tree was a symbol of Nebuchadnezzar there, and a symbol of that kingdom. We have the other example where, I believe it's in the book of Ezekiel, where it talks about a high cedar tree and cutting off a tender branch. And the first part was the king of Judah, and then the tender one be one of the daughters, as Mr. Armstrong used to describe that. So when we speak of trees, sometimes we're speaking of people. And God is not against all the trees as such. There's more to it than that. He says, upon the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up. In other words, no matter how big and how strong and how whatever you think you are, and upon the oaks of Bashan, maybe you think you're tough, you know, you're an oak tree. Upon all the high mountains, and we know that mountains are a symbol of governments. And upon all the hills that are lifted up, little countries today who think that they're so strong. It says, upon every high tower and upon every fortified wall, upon all the ships of Tarshish and upon all the beautiful sloops, the loftiness of man shall be bowed down. God is not concerned about trees being lofty. He's talking about mankind. And the haughtiness of men shall be brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day, but the idols he shall utterly abolish. They shall go into the holes of the rocks, enter the caves of the earth, from the terror of the Eternal and the glory of His majesty when He arises to shake the earth mightily. Or as it says in the King James Version, when He arises to shake terribly the earth. Verse 20, in that day a man will cast away his idols of silver and his idols of gold, which they have made each for himself to worship, to the moles and the bats, to go into the clefts of the rocks and into the crags of the rocky, rugged rocks, from the terror of the Lord and the glory of His majesty when He arises to shake the earth mightily. And then the advice here is, sever yourselves from such a man whose breath is in his nostrils, for of what account is he? This is what the day of the Lord is about. at least part of it. But there is good news. We know that there is good news this day. And I think it's important for our young people to realize that it's not all just doom and gloom. Yes, it is about some doom and gloom that takes place on this earth for a period of time. A one-year period of time when hopefully you're going to be in a place of safety. And that's going to follow the great tribulation and all those heavenly signs, all those things are happening. There is some good news. Over in Matthew, the 24th chapter, I want to focus on a part of it that we don't always focus on. I think we're all familiar with it, but we need to think about what it means. Matthew 24, verse 21. It shows us just how bad things are going to get. It says, "For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be." And then in verse 22 it says, "Unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved." So it shows us that, in the rest of this verse, that yes, God is going to spare this earth. When I grew up, we talked about the end of the earth. I mean, we didn't talk about it much, but in the church setting was, everybody's dead. And that's not what the Bible says. The Bible shows there are going to be a lot of survivors. A lot of people are not going to survive that 3.5 year period and even things leading up to it. Huge percentages of mankind are going to be killed. But there are those who will live on into the millennium. And there are the people of God. And notice what it says here. "Lest those days were shortened, no flesh could be saved." But why? Why is God going to save mankind? "For the elect's sake, those days will be shortened." Now, who are the elect? I'm looking at the elect here. I realize that probably, just knowing how things go in the church over time, that I get myself in trouble when I say these things, but probably some of you are not going to be there. And I don't mean because you died, but because you're going to cast everything aside. That's just reality. It's sad. I don't know who. Frankly, sometimes it surprises you who stays and who doesn't. God knows who are His. But nevertheless, in a general sense, I'm looking at the elect, at least some of the elect. And all over this world, the elect have been meeting together at this time, on this day. And we're learning about these things because of us. Now that's really hard for us to swallow, isn't it? Because of us, because of the people of God, He's going to spare mankind. It's hard to believe, isn't it? It's hard to think that, well, maybe we're that important. Well, if we get puffed up about it, we probably won't be there. But nevertheless, God has called us. He's given us a privilege. Our young people sometimes think, oh, everything's doom and gloom and it's bad. But you've been given an opportunity to survive the future and to be a leader in tomorrow's world. Living on into tomorrow's world, some who are here, perhaps younger ones, perhaps older ones, get married, have children, and be able to raise those children in a world very different from our world today, without fentanyl, without gangs, without all the things that are out there, all the dangers that are out there for our children. There is not only hope, but there is really a promise of good things if we understand the Scriptures and we live according to them. God offers safety to His zealous servants. Notice over in Isaiah 26. Isaiah 26. It's not a promise exactly here in Isaiah 26. It's really asking a question when you look at it. In verse 20 and 21, He says, "Come, my people." Are we the people of God or are we not? If we are the people of God, if we don't believe we are, what are we doing here? But he says, come, my people, enter your chambers and shut your doors behind you. Hide yourself, as it were, for a little moment until the indignation is past. Now, it's not talking about you going to your closet in your home. It's talking about, you know, more than that. We have to put all the scriptures together. But it's saying, hide out for a short time until the indignation, the wrath of God, is past. For behold, the Lord comes out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth will also disclose her blood and will no more cover her sins. I'm sorry, her slain. So that's what he's saying, that there is a time. He says, come, enter into your chambers, hide out. There comes a time when we'll have an opportunity to hide out from the terrible times ahead. I remember when I first learned the truth, and one of the reasons I wanted to go to Ambassador College, and I wanted to be there because where I was on the coast of California, the radio program, that's all we had then, would kind of come in and leave. It was halfway. It was closer to Los Angeles than San Francisco, but KGO out of San Francisco would come and go. And so I'd have to listen to it very low, so my parents didn't know what I was doing. And I'd listen to it very low. And I knew at a certain point in time that there was a promise of going to a place of safety. I wanted to go to Ambassador College because I didn't want to miss the word when it went out. Now, again, like so many people, I was afraid of the things that prophecy tells us, the terrible times. But, you know, some people never got past that. They loved prophecy. They thought, okay, if there's a way of escape, I want to get out of the tribulation. But then when the tribulation didn't come when they thought it would, I don't have to do these things. You know, we have to get past that fear and come to the place where we have enough love of the truth and love for the calling that God has given us and a sense of responsibility, as was brought out in the sermonette this morning, of doing the work. We have to do that. If we don't pass beyond that, something's going to come up and we're not going to stay. We have to go beyond a fear of bad things and come to love what God is offering to us and the hope and the responsibility that he's given to us and the understanding of why we are here to do a work. Over in Psalm 91, I think I'll skip over that, but some think that Psalm 91, I'll turn over there briefly, really has to do with a time in the future, a place of safety, and I'm sure that there are many applications to Psalm 91, but it is interesting, if you read through the whole thing, that it does seem to be a protection in a time of very grave danger. Where it begins, he who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in him I will trust. Surely he shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler, as someone who has a net to catch the birds, and from the perilous pestilence. He shall cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you shall take refuge. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by the day. Some have likened that to missiles traveling overhead. You know, 1,000 will fall at your right hand or your side, and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. I'm sure that there are many applications of this. It may refer to a place of safety at the end, but more importantly, something that is more direct is over in the book of Revelation, in Revelation, the 12th chapter. And in verse 13, we see that this is following history from the time of physical Israel all the way down to the end, where spiritual Israel is shown in verse 17, as we'll see. But let's begin in verse 13. It says, now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, This is after a future battle and at the end of the age. He persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the woman was given two wings of great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time, for a 3.5 year period, from the presence of the serpent. Verse 15, so the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood, perhaps an army, after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. Or it could be a literal flood, as we've seen recently how flooding waters can carry people away. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth, and the dragon was enraged with the woman. This is the church. And he went to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. That's not physical Israel. That's spiritual Israel, who have the testimony of Jesus Christ and who keep the commandments of God. So there are those who have the commandments of God, who have the testimony of Jesus Christ, or they keep the commandments and they have the testimony of Jesus Christ, but there's something missing. And I think that Mr. Smith and Mr. Rolston were very clear this morning that there's more to it than just keeping the commandments and taking care of the self and having the knowledge of Jesus Christ. God expects us to do a work. And that has been a hallmark of God's true servants, from Mr. Armstrong, Dr. Meredith, and it remains the same today, as we can see. We have a work to do. Otherwise, why did God call us? As I have asked the question, if God didn't call everybody, why is he calling anyone? And the answer is, he's not just calling us for personal salvation, which is what much of the world sees. He's calling us to do a work, to warn this world, and also to, you know, prepare for the future, but to do the work of God, to warn the world and give the gospel to the world. There's a new world that is coming, but it must not begin the foundation of this world. This is where I accuse Mr. Smith of stealing my material. In Genesis, the sixth chapter, Genesis 6, we find that it wasn't that many years, a few hundred years, and mankind had gotten totally off track. And in verse 5, Genesis 6, verse 5, then the Eternal saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. You know, you look at today's movies. Now, there are a few actually halfway decent movies out there. Some of them are created by different companies, and they don't have they're not the big blockbusters usually. But you look at the darkness that comes over these things, Action Murderers, and I don't know, I don't even understand the advertisements of some of these movies and what's out there. You go to a movie and they have all the trailers beforehand, and you think, really, what is there to watch? He says, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, verse 7, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry I have made him. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Eternal. And then down in verse 11, the earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Now what we see here is that God looked down upon the earth and he said, I can't reform what I see here. I've got to start over. And so he allowed all of mankind to be killed, and the beasts and the birds and all kinds of creatures on this earth to be destroyed. And he started over with one man and his family. And when you read the history, how long did that go before man corrupted himself once again? But when he looked down on the earth, he understood there was no turning mankind around the way that it was. In a very smaller scale, in the 1970s, Mr. Herbert Armstrong realized that Ambassador College had gotten so far off track that what did he do? He shut it down. He bought out all the faculty members, and he started all over again. He realized that at that point, you couldn't reform it. The rot was too deep, and he started all over again. Even more recently, Jesus Christ understood that the worldwide Church of God had strayed so far off track, not just the college, but now the church itself had strayed so far off track, had gotten so wrapped up in social activities and, you know, these tournaments and other tournaments and various things and people so wrapped up in the world that Jesus Christ didn't try to reform the worldwide Church of God. He took certain ones out, including some of us in this room, and started all over again with Dr. Meredith and a very, very small number of people. Mr. Davis was there at the time, about, 19 people at the first kind of informal service and about 40 or 41 at the first official service. He started all over again. And it wasn't long before he had a magazine and before he was on the radio preaching the gospel to the world. God had to start it all over again. Now, similarly, trumpets, as we heard this morning, tells us that our world is like an unsalvageable, condemned building that must first be torn down and a new world begun after that. How would we reform our world today? Consider our institutions, education. Does anybody think that any leader is going to be able to, even if he understood what needed to be done, could reform our educational system? Here in the United States, we have, I forget the various percentages, depending on where it is, but anywhere from 20 to 35% of foreign teachers, people that are tenured, who have very different attitudes toward this country than others. You know, it isn't just the presidents of some of these large institutions, which is kind of interesting in itself. God says that women shall rule over them, and there have been about four of these major Ivy League schools that have had their presidents have to resign. All women. But it's not, when you dig deeper, it's not just their fault. Their hands are tied. Based on what I heard from them, I wasn't too impressed with them. And, of course, one of them had cheated and done all kinds of things. But, nevertheless, the problem is so deep with what we see happening, the protests that are out there. You have teachers, tenured teachers, who are stirring up strife against the Jews. How would we reform education? Education is corrupt on many grounds, including science. The foundation of virtually all education is evolution. But science and technology, how would you reform that? How would you turn back to things that we ought to be doing instead of things that we're not doing? What about commerce and industry? It's interesting that Robert Kennedy Jr., I think has hit the nail on the head with a lot of this. You read this from many sources that we are one of the sickest nations on earth because of our over-processed foods, because of all the additives, because of the GMO products. we have people that are coming up with all kinds of strange diseases, children, things that you never heard of before. Cancer is on the rise. All kinds of problems because of what we're doing to ourselves. Anybody think that any leader is going to be able to turn around the agricultural business? All these food companies, do we have anybody that's able to turn around? How would they do it? You could have someone, the president, he couldn't do it by himself. He'd have to have the Congress, and you've got all these lobbyists, the whole system, which really brings it back to government. Can we reform this government or any other government? Sometimes you can have an overthrow of government, but even then, are we going to be able to reform our world? What about religion? Sometimes people say, well, I don't understand why, you know, if we told these people they would keep the Sabbath, or I don't understand why they don't keep the Sabbath. And you have to say, you're not going to change them. They're too ingrained. How do we reform religion in our world today? When Christ comes back, they're the very ones that are going to fight against him. They'll think he's the Antichrist. And what about the social order? Today, the social order is married to science and technology, to commerce and industry, to education, and it's become a religion in itself. Last week, Mr. Jonathan McNair talked about social media and the internet, among other things. Mr. Smith mentioned it earlier today. You know, I just have to say, parents in the church don't get it. They don't get it. You don't get it. We have no idea of the dangers that are out there. We think, well, my kid is different, or my grandchild is different. They're not going to be influenced by this stuff. You know, even this book, The Anxious Generation, comes from an evolutionary perspective. But that doesn't mean you have to throw the whole book out. Because there are things here that they've noticed that since about 2013, when the smartphone came out and more than 50% of young people had them, all of a sudden anxiety, depression, all kinds of things happened to young people. There are four dangers that he points out here. And these are truly dangers that, or harms, that a world based on a cell phone existence, as opposed to kids going out and playing and, you know, having fun together differently, but a cell or a electronic existence, there are four harms that he brings out here. The first one is social deprivation. And he's got charts and statistics of what's happened. And how young people, instead of socializing the way they once did, instead of laying in the grass, looking up at the sky, and believe me, my world was not perfect. But it was normal. It was normal in the sense of what kids did. Whether it's going fishing, or whether it's laying there looking up at the clouds and fellowshipping and talking with one another. But our world today, where everybody's in his own little room with little exercise, Dr. Winnell talked about, was it in an article or was it the Bible study that he gave last time, about how we need to move. I think maybe it was a sermon that I was listening to. Talked about how we need to move. We were intended to move. But instead, people just sit there in their own little darkened room on the internet. Or if they're on a bus or anyplace else, everybody's down looking here instead of looking up at those around them. He speaks of social deprivation is one of the harms. The second one is sleep deprivation. He says sleeping deprived teens cannot concentrate, focus, or remember as well as teens who get sufficient sleep. Their learning and their grades suffer. Their reaction times, decision making, and motor skills suffer, which elevates their risk of accidents. You know, I can't raise your children for you. Okay, put it as my opinion. It's not just my opinion. It's the opinion of a lot of experts out there. But if you've got a 12 or 13-year-old and they've got their cell phone and they have power over it so they can be in their room looking at it in the middle of the night, you're making a terrible mistake. Kids are kids. And there are certain things that they're going to do. I remember when I first started to learn to like reading. Now, Mr. Riley would remember this, Enid Blyton books. I was living in England at the time. I never liked to read up until that time, but she had these exciting, it was kind of like the Hardy Boys, or I guess. I never read the Hardy Boys, but it was one of these kind of children's adventure books. And I remember that. I remember some of the things. One of them was ginger beer. It sounded so good. They'd always stop and get a ginger beer. And I thought, man, that sounds good, until I had one. It was like soapy, gray soapy water, as far as I could tell. It was awful. But it was exciting. And I would, when my parents were gone, I would have the light on there and have the cover over it so that I could read, because I'd hear them pull up and then I could turn it off. But I wanted to stay up and read. Now, if I did that, I'd be sleep deprived, I suppose. But nevertheless, that's different from being on the internet with who knows who, with strangers. And there's something about the blue light that we look into that keeps us from sleeping. They've done studies on this, and they tell you, turn it off at least an hour before you go to bed. Otherwise, it's harder to go to sleep. And so people have sleep deprivation for a number of reasons. Teens need more sleep than adults, at least 9 hours a night for preteens and 8 hours a night for teens. It says one experiment found that adolescents who restricted their use of screen devices after 9 p.m. on school nights for 2 weeks showed increased total sleep time, earlier sleep onset times, and improved performance on a task that required focused attention and quick reactions. What he's saying is that the technologies change our minds. They affect the way that we react. The third one is attention fragmentation. And he describes here how someone starts a task and they take an off-ramp. He says, every hyperlink, everybody knows what a hyperlink is. You're reading an article, it's got a hyperlink. Oh, that looks interesting. Now, I'm talking about teens, but I want all of us who are adults to think about this, because I see myself in this. It is not accidental. It is planned. It is purposeful. It says, every hyperlink is an off-ramp calling us to abandon the choice we made moments earlier. Capturing a child's attention with immediately exciting sensorial stimuli is the goal of app designers, and they are very good at what they do. He says, people can't really multitask. All we can do is shift attention back and forth between tasks while wasting a lot of time on each shift. And then it comes to the final part of it, which is addiction. And this is where it really gets interesting. He says, when you eat a potato chip, you get a small hit of dopamine, which is why you then want the second one even more than the first one. When I was in England, the fellow that lived with us, Jamie Meekin, and he came in one night and he had a bag of, I think it was Doritos, if I'm not mistaken. And it was something new. I don't know if it's available here, because I don't buy that stuff, so I don't know. But every sixth one was hot, spicy. And so you'd eat one, and you're looking for the spicy one. And every once in a while, you hit that spicy one. Now, that is deliberate. They know what they're doing. Why don't they make the whole bag spicy? Well, let me read why they don't. And forgive me if I read a little bit much here, but this explains it better than I can. He says, how do habit-forming products hook adolescents? And I say adolescents, and I'm speaking of all of us. It's not just adolescents. It may do them more harm immediately in terms of depression and that sort of thing, but how do they hook any of us? He says, take the case of a 12-year-old girl sitting at her desk at home, struggling to understand photosynthesis for a test in her science class the next day. How can Instagram lure her away and then keep her away for an hour? App designers often use a four-step process that creates a self-perpetuating loop. So the loop starts with an external trigger, such as a notification that someone commented on one of your posts. You know, ping. Now think about it. You hear that ping, what do? Do you leave it or do you go and check it out? That's step one, the off-ramp, inviting her to have the path she was on, or to leave the path she was on. It appears on her phone and automatically triggers a desire to perform an action that had previously been rewarded. Touching the notification to bring up the Instagram app, the action then leads to a pleasurable event, but only sometimes. And this is step number three, a variable reward. This is the Doritos with only one spicy chip for every six. Maybe she'll find some expression of praise or friendship, maybe not. This is a key discovery of behaviorist psychology. It's best not to reward a behavior every time. And speaking of animal studies, that the animal wants it. If you reward an animal on a variable rate schedule, such as one time in 10 or other times, but sometimes fewer, sometimes more, you create the strongest and most persistent behavior. When you put a rat into a cage where it has learned to get food by pressing a bar, it gets a surge of dopamine in anticipation of the reward. It runs to the bar and starts pressing. But if the first few presses yield no reward, that does not dampen the rat's enthusiasm. Rather, as the rat continues to press, dopamine levels go up in anticipation of the reward. Can you see somebody in a slot machine? How that works? He knows it's coming at any moment. When the reward finally comes, he feels great. But the heightened levels of dopamine make the rat continue to press in anticipation of the next reward, which will come after some unknown number of presses. So just keep pressing. There's no off-ramp in an app with a bottomless feed. There's no signal to stop. These three steps are classic behaviorism. They deploy apparent or operant conditions as taught by this individual in the 1940s. What the hooked model adds for humans is step four, investment. Humans can be offered ways to put a bit of themselves into the app so that it matters more to them. The girl who has already filled out her profile posted many photos of herself and linked herself to all her friends plus hundreds of other Instagram users. It says her brother is studying for an exam in the room next to her, and he has spent hundreds of hours accumulating digital badges, purchased skins, and made other investments in video games such as Fortnite and Call of Duty. I don't know what those are, skins, but badges, whatever it is. He's getting a reward. So he has a problem in a different way. At this point, after investment, the trigger for the next round of behavior may become internal. The girl no longer needs a push notification to call her over to Instagram. As she is rereading a difficult passage in her textbook, the thought pops up in her mind, I wonder if anyone has liked the photo I posted 20 minutes ago. An attractive off-ramp appears in conscious. She tries to resist temptation and stick with her homework, but the more thought of a possible reward triggers the release of a bit of dopamine, which makes her want to go to the Instagram immediately. So you don't even have to have a ping anymore. Curiosity. Anybody recognize that? I see it myself. And, you know, being older and more mature, we can sometimes, you know, make choices that way. But a young person who's brain is not fully formed. That's not a slam on anybody. They know that the frontal cortex, which has to do with decision-making and risk-taking and various things like that, is not fully formed yet. And they're just like a lab rat. I don't know about you, but if I'm a young person thinking and hearing about this, maybe reading about it, I don't think I'd like the idea of being a lab rat. What about us adults? Are we allowing ourselves to become guinea pigs, lab rats? Not, worse than guinea pig, it's not an experiment. It's already figured out. We're just doing what they want us to do. And we've had articles such as taming the social media monster and other articles, but I don't think people get it. Our world, Satan is the god of this world. This is one reason that God is going to have to destroy all this. We sometimes wonder, will we have computers in tomorrow's world? Well, if we do, it's going to be after the whole thing collapses and has to start over from the beginning again. Because how do we reform it? Think about it. What is one of the big topics in the news and among politicians and executives? It has to do with censorship, doesn't it? What should we censor and who determines it? Does anybody think we can reform this system without making it even worse? I don't think so. Dark clouds don't always look frightening. They may even look beautiful and attractive. But how do we know whether something is good or not? Well, over in Matthew, the 7th chapter, Matthew 7, in verse 15, it says, "Beware of false prophets." Now, I know that this is talking about religion and so forth, but there's a principle here. "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing. They look good, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves." These people that come to us and tell us how wonderful social media is and how it brings people together and all this sort of thing, they come as ravenous wolves. They know what they're doing. They know how to addict you and me. And as I think Mr. Smith brought out, they know what you like. They know what attracts you, what turns you on. And through all these algorithms, if you're a flat earther, you're going to get all kinds of flat earth stuff. That's how we have a world believing in the flat earth. I think we would be shocked at how many people believe in a flat earth, which is absolute insanity with all of the technology and everything. I mean, they pull verses out of scripture that are out of context, that are metaphorical, and they try to make it a religious thing. I know one of our ministers said that in this particular area, that every go-to is a flat earther. How do we have people so divided in our country, either conservative or liberal or however you want to describe it? We are at such odds because they feed us what we want to hear. They know what you like. They know more about you than you probably know about yourself. I say you, us. I'll include myself in that. They know so much about us. And they know how to hook us if they can. Thinking people recognize that this monster is beyond rehabilitation. He says here, where was it? Chapter 7 and verse 15. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Even so, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a bad tree bear good fruit. Verse 19, every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. This world is going to come down. This world is going to be destroyed so that Christ can rebuild from the bottom up once again, or the top down. Therefore, by their fruits you will know them. What are the fruits of social media and all? Well, it started out, it looked pretty promising. It looked pretty good. It looked like a beautiful cloud out there. But it's become a dark cloud of depression, anxiety, and so forth. The Feast of Trumpets tells us our world is beyond repair. It shows us there's a time to start all over again. And that is what happened in the days of Noah. That is what is about ready to happen with this Feast of Trumpets, that God is going to bring it down. The Feast of Trumpets is about a new world, about white fluffy clouds against a deep blue sky. It's about the return of Jesus Christ to transform this world. Today foretells a time of dark clouds and storms, but it also foretells a time of deep blue skies and white fluffy clouds. It foretells a time of rainbows and rain in due season. It foretells a time when children will be able to grow up without being manipulated by greedy individuals who just want to make more money. It foretells the day of the resurrection for some, and a big new world for our children to live in and to raise their families in peace and prosperity. We'll learn more about that world, how Satan, who is behind all of this, and he is clever, how he's going to be removed, how the millennium will come about, and how God is going to give all these deceived people who never realized how much they were manipulated this way and a thousand other ways, are going to have their opportunity. And that's what we'll be studying. That's what we'll be learning about in the days ahead.